Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week we've got a special show lined up, and Holly Fox is joining me in the studio.
We'll be focusing on the dispute over applying Europe's emissions trading scheme to aviation.
Airline business is a global business. We fly not only against other European airlines, but also other airlines from the Gulf.
The airline business is not magic. It might be competitive. The cost of the emissions trading scheme at the moment is a few dollars on a ticket. It's less than they would sell a packet of sandwiches on such a flight. It's just another cost of business. You just deal with it and get on with it.
Well, what has happened so far is the opposite. There's an anti-EU ETS bill in the United States. The Chinese have done likewise. The Russians, a government, likewise have indicated that they will take retaliatory measure. That's not what we want.
We'll also hear what Western Australian lifesavers think of a spate of recent shark attacks. So stick around. I'm Nathan Woodcop. Welcome to Living Planet. The European Union's emissions trading scheme is supposed to tackle the greenhouse gases blamed for climate change. It sets a cap on the amount of carbon industries can pollute and makes them trade for permits to go over budget.
It's supposed to be a carrot-and-stick approach to letting the market sort out an efficient way to cut emissions. Europe's carbon market, known as the ETS for short, is the biggest in the world. It was introduced in 2005. But starting this year, it was extended to air travel for the first time. Any airline taking off or landing in a European airport will need to account for at least some of the emissions of that flight on the EU's carbon market.
International airlines are furious because they too will be obliged to take part. They mounted a legal challenge, but their case was dismissed by Europe's top court last month.
And it's not just foreign airlines that are upset. European carriers are also crying foul.
That's right. We divided up the reporting on this to bring you the different views, and we're going to start in Frankfurt, the heart, if not the headquarters, of the German carrier Lufthansa.
Lufthansa is the world's second largest long-haul carrier and was one of the first airlines to say that it would be passing the cost of the emissions trading scheme on to customers in a fuel surcharge. I asked spokesman Andreas Bartels what Lufthansa's problem with the ETS is.
Well, it costs extra money, and it is a disadvantage in the global competition. Airline business is a global business. We fly not only against other European airlines, but also other airlines from the Gulf area or from other parts of the world are competing against Lufthansa. And if we were the only airlines, the European ones, who have to pay for it and who have to take part in this emission trading scheme, then it would be a disadvantage. We see that other airlines of other parts of the world are not willing to take part in it. And we see politicians of other areas of the world which are very reluctant to put their carriers in this kind of system.
Now, we should point out that EU rules are clear that any carrier that tries to cheat will face penalties and may even have its access rights curtailed. But as we'll hear, that's not the only concern of European carriers. First, though, I hear you had a bit of trouble trying to get passengers to share their feelings with you on this subject.
Yeah, that's right. But I did manage to talk with one American woman named Mary Salisville, who was on a layover in Frankfurt on her way to Denmark for business. I asked her if she worried about her emissions when she flew.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And I think I had heard recently that United actually, if they haven't already, I think they're switching to biodiesel. And so that does play a part in the decision of, you know, who to fly with.
Biodiesel. Interesting. We'll be coming back to that one later.
Anyway, Nathan, while I was hanging out at the airport in Frankfurt, you were in Brussels, right?
That's right. I went to speak to two opposing lobbies on this. Let's hear first from the aviation perspective. This is Ulrich Schulte-Strathaus. He's Secretary General of the Association of European Airlines. I asked him why he thought aviation deserved to be exempted from Europe's emissions trading scheme when other industries have been a part of it for years.
We never actually said they should be exempt. We believe they should be included in a global scheme. Why?
But there isn't a global scheme. There's a European scheme. Isn't it a step forwards towards a global scheme?
Aviation is an industry that has, I hate to say this as an industry rep, but has factories with wings, light factories, of course, otherwise they wouldn't be able to fly, but it's factories with wings. In other words, they're mobile And the question is, how do you allocate those emissions to which countries? With surface-bound emitters, it's fairly straightforward. With aircraft, it isn't. So you need a global mechanism for that allocation. Any regional scheme, by definition, cannot resolve a global issue. So we have been advocating a global scheme from the very start.
Do you fear competition from abroad will be intensified due to this scheme, that other carriers that aren't as exposed to it will win out over European carriers?
Yes. There are hubs. As you know, aviation depends very much on a hub structure internationally, and it is far cheaper to fly from, say, the United States via a hub outside of Europe into Europe than it is to fly to a hub in Europe and then to the final destination. So a service, I don't know, from Beijing via Moscow to Paris would be covered by the European Emissions Trading Scheme only to the extent that you have the flight from Moscow to Paris, not the Beijing to Paris. So the airline that has the hub in Moscow benefits. It pays less.
Those arguments, they sound interesting, but there's very little behind them.
Let me guess, that would be the other guy you spoke to in Brussels?
That's right. Bill Hemmings is an aviation specialist at the Green Lobby Group Transport and Environment. And he says the idea that airlines are going to fly different routes, even longer ones, to avoid emissions charges, is overstated.
Very little of that will happen. If you're an airline and you want to serve Europe, then you need to fly into a European airport. You make money as an airline by premium business traffic. Business travellers always want to fly non-stop. No one is going to fly from Hong Kong to London and land in Istanbul just so that they could save a few dollars on a carbon permit.
The aviation sector's main complaint is that flying is inherently global and there's a global body that's been tasked with taking care of the sector's problems.
It's called ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Authority.
International aviation is dependent on governments agreeing on how to treat these aircraft. And the international body that we have of the United Nations is called ICAO, a specialized body of director generals of civil aviation. They are the body to agree on how best to do that.
The trouble for critics is this UN body just hasn't been taking care of business.
It's a very good question. They were left to handle this in 1997 under the Kyoto Protocol. They've been talking for 14 years and they're still talking. They've gone round in circles. They've rejected this. They've rejected that. They've rejected a global emissions trading scheme. They've recommended local schemes. And when Europe comes up with a local scheme, they say, no, we want a global scheme. They had an assembly last year where they committed themselves to do what they said they would do in 2004 and look at a global scheme, but they're only looking at a framework for the next 3 years. We want action, and there hasn't been action, which is why Europe has gone alone.
Are you saying they're happy to sit on their hands?
It's not easy. It's a United Nations organisation. There are all sorts of countries there. The problems in ICAO are reflected in the global climate change negotiations, where the developing countries are arguing that they don't have a responsibility to cut emissions now. But the fact is that ICAO was given this special responsibility because international aviation emissions and shipping emissions are different because they cut across borders. So you need some cross-border solution, and that's why it was thought the ICAO could do that.
Okay, so back to the trading scheme. Now, the thing is, airlines won't have to bid on a market for all of the emissions in their cap. They get a whole bunch of allowances for free.
So far, the EU has given industries in the ETS a percentage of free allowances that's meant to decrease over time to help them adjust.
For aviation, that percentage starts out at 85% of their allowances. They'll only have to bid for the remaining 15%. The thing is, these certificates are worth money. And despite all the complaints from US airlines, this week a study backed by the US Federal Aviation Authority actually found that US carriers could profit from the certificates handed out for free under Europe's ETS.
So this appears in the Journal of Air Transport Management, and I'll quote from the abstract here. If carriers pass on all additional costs, including the opportunity costs associated with free allowances to consumers, profits for U.S. carriers will increase.
In fact, utilities companies here reaped just these kinds of windfall profits when the EU first introduced the scheme. So I put it to Schulte Strathaus that maybe airlines are quietly preparing for the same.
We don't believe that there's any possibility for windfall profits. Let's start with one of the assumptions that that study apparently is based upon. The directive foresees that 85% of the allowances are given to the operators free of charge, and therefore 15% must be purchased. But the reference year is 2005. Between 2005 and 2012, there has been growth. And we calculate that we now do not need 100%, but actually 115% of the allowances that must be surrendered next year. So there are more allowances that need to be bought than the study is assuming. That is for the first year. In addition to which, the price of these CO2 allowances will increase significantly. Now, in light of such figures, you might have individual airlines, if they go bankrupt or if they actually shrink in size, that will have more allowances than they need. But apart from these individual exceptions, this is a growth industry that has grown in the past years, will continue to grow, and therefore the costs of these allowances will definitely increase to such a degree that they won't be able to make any benefit from them.
It sounds like a very similar argument to what the energy sector in Europe was making several years ago, and yet the price of carbon emissions reduction permits is at record lows, and they did come away with windfall profits. Why won't it be the same for aviation?
A, because aviation, as I said, is a growth sector. The more economies grow, the more aviation will grow. B, because aviation depends on fossil fuels. It cannot simply shift to electric energy or other sources. So as it grows, it will require more fuel. And C, because the cap of this emissions trading scheme is going to be gradually reduced. So in addition to the growth, you've got a reduction of the cap, so you'll be having to buy more and more allowances. So there are specific differences to the energy sector. We have no substitute sources of energy, and we're in an extremely competitive international environment, which again is the main driving force for us to insist that whatever the scheme, it must be an international one.
One of the airline's biggest concerns about a price on carbon emissions is that airplanes just don't have much flexibility when it comes to fuel.
They need kerosene, and they're going to need more because business is growing.
The working assumption for us is that in the foreseeable future, we will continue to be dependent on kerosene, and there will be an increase in the demand for kerosene, and we assume that the price for kerosene will increase. Now, does that mean there will be less flying? No. There is a huge amount of growth that we anticipate coming from Asia. You can expect a middle class of 250 million people wanting to travel internationally. So there is a growth that at a global level will be out there for years and decades to come.
Okay, so what does Bill Hemmings from Environment and Transport have to say about that?
Well, I put it to him, so let's have a listen.
Airlines do face some peculiar challenges, though, don't they? It's not like they can switch to renewable energies that may be a little bit more expensive but still do the trick. No one's going to invent a battery anytime soon that will fly an aeroplane across the Atlantic. They need fuels like kerosene.
Yes, and probably aviation is going to be one of the last industries relying upon fossil fuels. No one underestimates the difficulties facing aviation in general. At the same time, you can't ignore the carbon footprint that it's creating. Historically, aviation emissions account for about 4.9% of global warming. If we don't cap and reduce aviation emissions, they will continue to grow at the current rate of growth of international aviation, which is, I don't know, depending on where we are in the economic crisis, between 3 and 5% a year. If you grow at that rate compounded over 20 years, what is a 5% share today of the world's emissions could end up being 12 or 15%. And so, yes, it's going to be difficult, but we need to start somewhere.
The airline business is cutthroat as it is. Isn't asking carriers to accept a rising price on carbon basically asking them to agree to suicide in the foreseeable future?
You know, the airline business is not magic. It might be competitive. The cost of the emissions trading scheme at the moment is a few dollars on a ticket. And as we've seen with some of the carriers announcing the surcharges that they're now putting on, Delta, I think, talked about $3 across the Atlantic on one way. I mean, look at that amount of money. It's less than they would sell a packet of sandwiches on such a flight. Let's be realistic. Airline pricing is complex, it's varied, and it's changing all the time. And they have had every opportunity, and some of them may well have already factored these costs into their pricing, and they're doing that now, and they will continue to do it. It's just another cost of business. It's a bit like walking in the office one day and finding out that the electricity bill has gone up, your rent has gone up, or the interest rate's gone up. You just deal with it and get on with it.
Build a bridge.
Take a concrete pill and stiffen up.
Okay, so there's some tough love there. But Schulte Strathaus from the Association of European Airlines says the industry is working hard to reduce its fuel consumption. He says it's making a four-pronged assault.
The industry is very special in the sense that some years ago, every single stakeholder globally agreed that there must be four different measures that we need to envisage. And these are being implemented in order to reduce unnecessary fuel consumption. I know of no other sector that has such a global agreement within the industry to do that. So it's through technological innovation, infrastructural improvements, the way the air traffic is managed and the amount of airports on the ground. It's through operational measures, descent processes that will reduce emissions, and it's through things like taxes and ETS that actually have an impact on demand. So a combination of these four measures would optimize, so to speak, the consumption and decouple traffic growth from emissions growth. Now, whether or not the next generation of aircraft will lead to such a significant reduction of fossil fuels, whether or not biofuels that are under research, as you know, will have a significant role to play in the years to come remains to be seen.
Now, this idea that biofuels can gradually substitute kerosene and lead to some big emissions savings over time is something that came up when you were in Frankfurt, right?
That's right. This is Andreas Bartels from Lufthansa, whom we heard from earlier.
Well, we plan to halve our emissions until 2050, and that's the overall goal of the IATA Airlines. So it's a very ambitious goal, which is not known from other traffic providers.
50% by 2050 sounds like a lot, and I should clarify those numbers come from IATA, the International Air Transport Association.
My mum was a travel agent, so that one abbreviation is one that I knew how to pronounce this week. Some of the others I had to look up. Anyway, I also thought IATA's numbers sounded a little optimistic for an industry that's stuck with oil and growing. So I asked Bill Hemmings if he thought this target was greenwash.
I think that's probably a kind word for it. They've not explained how they're going to achieve that. Insofar as they've tried to explain it, most of that reduction seems to be biofuels.
And if you've been following this show for some time, you've probably heard us report on some of the familiar problems with biofuels. The current generation tend to be grown at the expense of tropical rainforests, either directly or indirectly, which doesn't do wonders for their overall climate impact.
Hemmings says another problem is that where airplanes burn their fuel could turn out to be more critical than what type of fuel they burn.
When you burn a kerosene or when you burn biofuels, the same stuff comes out of the back of the aircraft, and that creates nitrous oxides at cruise altitude and creates contrails and induces cirrus clouds. Those non-CO2 effects of aviation are possibly twice or three times worse for the climate than the kerosene emissions. And for biofuels and kerosene, what comes out of the back has exactly the same climate effect. So you're not addressing that at all.
Now, both the aviation industry and green groups like Transport and Environment agree outwardly that an international emissions trading scheme is the best thing to reduce the industry's climate impact, and that regional schemes like Europe's are less attractive.
But they draw opposite conclusions on whether the EU's move to apply the scheme to aviation this year is going to help or hinder an international deal. First, Bill Hemmings.
Absolutely. One could expect that even less would have been done in ICAO without the pressure that has been brought. We see on the international shipping side where similar discussions are underway in the European arena for a European measure that's prompting the International Maritime Organization to get moving on a global shipping scheme. And now I think that everyone is saying we don't want a regional European scheme, we want a global scheme. It's time for them all to stand up to the plate and say, yes, we want a global scheme, this is how it should be structured, and this is when we're going to implement it.
Well, what has happened so far is the opposite. Europeans did indeed begin with the ETS to create that pressure, but it gave rise to counter-pressure. There's an anti-EU ETS bill in the United States. The Indian minister yesterday came out with an announcement that they are going to also take retaliatory action if the EU insists on its ETS. The Chinese have done likewise. The Russians, a government likewise, have indicated that they will take retaliatory measure. That's not what we want. The pressure should not give rise to counter-pressure, which will lead to an automatism that will ultimately then mean that we'll have a trade conflict. No, we want to channel that pressure and jointly, together with particularly the United States, have a proposal that's workable, feasible, acceptable for the rest of the world be injected into this ICAO body.
That was Ulrich Schulte-Strathaus, Secretary-General of the Association of European Airlines, speaking there.
And before him, you heard aviation specialist Bill Hemmings from Transport and Environment, both based in Brussels.
Well, thanks for coming into the show this week, Holly, and helping out with the reporting on that story.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Living Planet, coming to you from Bonn in Germany. If you'd like to leave comments for the show, you can write to us at livingplanet@dw-world.de. That's one word for Living Planet. Coming up, are more sharks driving more shark attacks? Time now, though, for the environment news. Here's Matt Zavella.
Eco News.
China has begun an ambitious attempt to revitalize its wild panda population. On Wednesday, officials sent the first six pandas of a group bred in captivity into a protected area in southwestern Sichuan province. There, they are to be prepared for the wild. There are thought to be around 1,600 in the wild today, but they remain threatened by encroachment on their territory. Few born in captivity have survived in the wild. Germany's solar industry remained stable last year despite declining feed-in tariffs. This week, the industry's main trade association said 7.5 gigawatts of solar panels were installed last year, marginally more than in 2010. A group of scientists moved the symbolic doomsday clock a minute closer to midnight this week. The group cited a lack of progress on nuclear weapons proliferation and climate change as the main reasons for shifting the time to 5 minutes to midnight. At the beginning of 2010, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the time back 1 minute, citing hope that leaders were making progress on large global threats. And finally, Hong Kong media report that the city's air pollution levels reached record highs last year. On Monday, the South China Morning Post reported that official pollution levels were above a 100-point threshold 20% of the time. That's 10 times worse than 2005, when they exceeded the ceiling 2% of the time.
That was Matt Zavella with the environment news. If you're looking for more environment news, come check out our website at dwworld.de/environment. A spate of lethal shark attacks in Western Australia has provoked fears and questions among locals and tourists alike. Though shark sightings are common in Australia, deaths are rare. On average, about one person has died of a shark attack each year for the past 50 years. But in Western Australia, four people have died in the last 18 months. The government there has recently approved millions of dollars for safety programs. Jonathan Gifford went to the beach to look behind the attacks.
For many Australians, the long, hot summer means at least one day at the beach. And for others, the sun, sea and surf are a way of life. But in the lead-up to summer 2011-12, beachgoers in the southwest of Western Australia were shocked by three fatal shark attacks in the space of a few weeks. Jean Burling has been involved in surf lifesaving at Cottesloe Beach for over 50 years and says that while sharks have always been a part of life on the beach, that the number of large sharks being spotted has certainly increased.
Now with aerial surveillance, there's a lot more opportunity to see the sharks or dolphins or whatever they may be out there. And the fact that there's a limit on actually fishing, because in the olden days people would go out and set shark lines and probably catch the sharks out in their rock nest, whereas none of that happening now, I don't believe.
The surveillance Burling mentions comes in the form of two helicopters, which have introduced a new sound to WA beaches. The helicopter passed over while Craig Bowley was explaining how the patrols work. He's a services coordinator for Surf Life Saving Western Australia.
If we have any reports from people on the beach, generally the helicopter will go and investigate. Western Australian Water Police also contact us via text message with regards to sightings. And we also obviously have radio contact with them, and we will go and investigate it. If it is a shark, if it's over 2 metres, generally we'll get hold of the local beach rangers or council rangers, and they'll come down and put up the necessary signage. If they're lifeguards on the beach, generally they'll close the beach and put the signs out.
But with a heightened awareness, often big dark shapes in the water, particularly if they have a dorsal fin, can cause some unnecessary panic.
We had an incident actually here the other day where some dolphins came in quite close and there was pandemonium, people screaming and shouting, running out of the water, but fortunately for them it was only dolphins.
But dolphins haven't been the only dark shapes that have caused concern.
We had a whale shark yesterday, which is harmless, fortunately, but we've had tiger sharks, white pointers, bronze whalers, hammerheads, you name it, we've pretty much sighted it through the summer.
And the appearance of the harmless 6-metre whale shark may hold some insight into why so many larger sharks are coming closer to the beach. Normally seen only in more northern, tropical waters, the whale sharks were thought to have been attracted by large schools of small fish coming closer to the shore. They're generally known as bait fish and can attract a host of larger predators. Jean Burling says that this is something she's not seen before, and that an increase in the number of whales using the vast coast as a highway is a second major factor.
We don't kill whales anymore, but yes, there's definitely a bigger migration situation arising, which is fantastic because some of them were bordering on extinction, so I think that's good. And yes, they go north to breed, and yes, they have, imagine the amount of afterbirth a whale has, so what do you expect with that? Naturally, the sharks are going to eat it.
With an increase in large sharks and some surfers and swimmers being taken, there have been calls for other measures to be put in place. Netting sections of the coast has been considered, and Cottesloe is one beach where an artificial groin or pier could be used to attach a net, as has been done in years past. But Burling isn't convinced.
I don't really think it's necessary because of the difference in the seas. In winter you get big seas. I mean, at the moment Cottesloe is flat calm, but in the wintertime we do get quite a surf, and I should imagine that the maintenance on shark netting would be a problem. And you also have the problem with the nets that it's not just only sharks that it catches, it can trap your dolphins and other fish, which I would hate to see.
Talk of shark culls was also pretty widespread and considered by the state government after the fatal attacks.
I don't really agree with it because I think we're in their domain, the ocean is their domain.
We don't condone the hunting of sharks and stuff like that. At the end of the day, people choose to swim in the shark's environment. If a shark is spotted, we have a policy in place where, we don't go and chase sharks. We'll follow them at a safe distance, but definitely don't condone the killing of them.
And surprisingly, many in the community agree. It seems that public opinion may have changed since the days of Jaws, when the only good shark was a dead one.
They've always been there. We're in their environments, and it's one of those things. You go swimming in the sea, you're bound to come across a shark sometime.
Well, I'm stinking hot sitting out of the wind here. Do you recommend I go in?
Yeah, go for it. Stay in between the red and yellow flags and, enjoy it.
I won't become lunch.
No. Hope not.
Jonathan Gifford with that report, and I can assure you that he didn't end up as lunch. It's knowing I'll be back at Echo Beach someday. That's all for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you liked the show. Don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter account is DW_eco. Till next week, I'm Nathan Whitcock. Bye for now. On a silent summer evening, the sky's alive with light. A building in the distance.